It's very nice indeed to be back on your campus again. The last time that I read my poems here was at least 10 or 12 or somebody said last night 15 years ago. At any rate, it's been quite a little while, and certainly I hope that all the students who were here then have graduated by now. Otherwise, they might hear me read many of the same poems again today, because in reading my poems about the country, I have found out that if you don't read the poems that students seem to have read in the anthologies or studied in college and heard about, they are disappointed. So I find myself reading many of the same poems that I was reading 10 or 12 years ago now on my programs. People ask, I suppose, of every poet, when did you begin to write? They very often ask, how do you write poetry? And sometimes people even ask, why do you write poetry? So I'm going to try to answer those questions as I go along, and I'm going to begin at the very beginning and tell you how I became a poet, when I wrote my first poem, because it was a kind of accident, really. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, but I belonged to a family that was always moving, and I wasn't really due to have been born in Joplin. I was due to have been born in Guthrie, Oklahoma, but we moved 2 weeks before I was born, so I was born in Joplin. Then before I could even learn to remember my hometown, we moved again, moved all the way to Buffalo, New York. So they told me. I don't remember Buffalo either. The first place that I remember is a town called Lawrence, Kansas, where the University of Kansas is. And I more or less grew up in Kansas, with occasional movings to Missouri, or occasional movings to Colorado, or somewhere nearby. But I consider myself very American, because Missouri is more or less the heart of our country, and Kansas is the very heart of the United States. There's a marker out there in that state marking the geographical center of our country. And so that's where I more or less grew up to the age of 13 or 14. Never wrote a thing, never dreamed about being a writer when I was a child. But when I was about 14, we moved to a town called Lincoln, Illinois, not too far from here. And we moved in November, I believe, in the fall of the year it was, certainly, about 4 or 5 weeks after the school term had begun. I was in the eighth grade. I don't believe they had junior high schools then, and you graduated in the eighth grade, then you went to high school. So I went into this eighth grade graduating class in Lincoln, Illinois, some weeks late, and on the day that I went into the class, they were talking about holding a class selection. It seemed that they'd just become aware that the high school graduate officers, so this grammar school class wanted to have officers too. So they were talking this day about the qualifications for a president, a secretary, and a treasurer, and so on, and they were going to have the nominations and election the next day. And the teacher was explaining to the class what each person would have to do if they were elected to an office, you see. So on the way home, I was talking about this with the one other Negro pupil in the class, a girl. And she said, oh, well, we don't have to worry about that old class election. They never elect Negroes to anything in these schools around here. This is a prejudiced little town, she told me. Well, it turned out, it seemed that she was just about right, certainly in regard to herself, because the next day, the nominations were made, and everybody was voted on, president, secretary, treasurer, and so on. The colored girl was not nominated for anything, although she had been with these pupils for the whole eighth grade. Well, when they got way down at the last office, way down at the bottom of the board, under sergeant-at-arms even, it was the office of class poet, and there weren't any nominations. No nominations whatsoever. And everybody looked around at each other and wondered who in the world to nominate for class poet. It seemed that there was nobody in the class who'd ever written a poem, nobody who even looked like he or she might write a poem, and so there were no nominations at all. So finally the teacher said, well, don't you want a class poet? And everybody said, yes. And she said, well, you have to nominate and elect someone. So at this point, a little white boy got up and turned around and looked at me and called my name, and right away the whole class said, I, unanimously, and that's the way... That is the way I became a poet, by unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, now, I didn't want to be class poet either. I'd never written a poem either. And I was a little bit put out, to tell the truth, that I was elected class poet. I wondered why. Well, as I thought about it that night at home, I came to the conclusion that it must have been because the day before, when the teacher was explaining the qualifications for a poet, she had stressed rhythm. She said a poem has to have rhythm. It has to sing. It must sometimes rhyme. It doesn't always have to rhyme, she said, but it does have to have rhythm. Well, now, you know, there is a kind of conventional belief in our country that all Negroes can sing and dance and that all of us have a sense of rhythm. Now, of course, that's not by any means 100% true. I happen to be one Negro that can't even carry a tune. In fact, I was excused from music all the way through high school because I threw everybody else off key. So it's certainly not true that all Negroes are rhythmical or musical at all. However, it is a kind of, conventional belief that it's true, a kind of cliche saying, really. And so I suppose that day, my white fellow classmates looking around and wondering who in the world to make class poet and remembering the word rhythm and looking at me colored, thought that I must have some rhythm to give a poem, and so they voted for me 100%. I, class poet Langston Hughes. So I was saddled with the class poem. Well, fortunately, I had all winter long to write that poem. It wasn't due until June for the class program, you know. So it turned out to be just about the longest poem I've ever written. I thought that I'd better have one verse for each teacher, and we had eight teachers, so there was eight verses. And I thought, well, the class certainly better have eight verses. So my first poem was 16 verses long, and real long verses, too. When I stood up and read this poem at graduation time, however, the parents, the teachers, the pupils, everybody seemed to like it. They all applauded very loudly. That was the first applause I'd ever had in my life, my first real appearance before a large crowd, I guess. And I was so pleased by all this applause that I thought to myself, well, I'll just keep on writing poems. So I did. The next year in high school, by this time, we had moved to Cleveland, Ohio. I went to Central High School in Cleveland. We had a very good school magazine called the Belfry Owl. I looked in the first issue or two, and I didn't see the names of any Negro pupils, quite a number of Negro pupils at Central at that time. Well, I've always had a lot of race pride, and I've always felt that we should do everything that any other American does. And so I thought to myself, well, if no other Negro students are trying to write for this magazine, I will try. So I began to write little poems, send them to our school magazine. Every month they came right straight back to my homeroom. Well, it wasn't prejudice, I'm sure. It was just they weren't very good. So they came back. But finally, one of my little poems was published in the high school magazine. And from that time on, almost every month until I graduated, I had something in the school magazine. I was again not the class poet, but the class songwriter. I did the lyrics for the class song. The same thing happened in college. I was the class lyricist for my college class. So my literary career really began in school. It developed through the help of my teachers, particularly my English teachers in school. And my advice to anyone who wants to be a writer is simply to begin to write wherever you are, to publish in the very nearest publication. If you're in college, publish in your college publication or your hometown paper. And the main thing, I think, is to be published someplace, because when you see something in print that you've written, it takes on another perspective from when you see it on the paper where you put it down yourself, and you can judge it better. We had one teacher in high school to whom I owe a very great deal. She happened to be a teacher who liked modern poetry. Well, now, that wouldn't be too unusual today, but when I was in high school 30 or more years ago now, most of the teachers seemed to like only the poets who had died about 100 years before the pupils were born, you know, or 200 years before. Shakespeare and Longfellow and Browning and people way back there. But this teacher would read to us from Carl Sandburg, from Edna St. Vincent Millay, from Edgar Lee Masters, from Vachel Lindsay, from poets who were living and writing right while we were living and writing about things that we knew. And I particularly liked Carl Sandburg's poetry. And so when I began to try to write poetry seriously in high school, I tried to write like Carl Sandburg. On the other hand, I had grown up with the poems of Paul Ernst Dunbar, who was our first really fine Negro poet. He died about the time that I was born, but when I was a child, almost every Negro home had a volume of Dunbar's poems. And my grandmother used to read Dunbar to me. My mother used to recite him at church socials and so on. And so I also tried to write like Dunbar. Well, now, they're two quite different styles. Paul Ernst Dunbar was a kind of singing, lyrical poet. Often he wrote humorously. He often wrote in Negro dialect, the quaint broken English of the period immediately following slavery in which he grew up. Sandburg, on the other hand, wrote, of course, as you know, in quite straightforward, plain English. He didn't rhyme. Often he didn't have a very obvious rhythm. In other words, he wrote free verse. Well, at that time, free verse was considered very radical. And I remember one of the big magazines denounced Carl Sandburg quite roundly as being not a poet at all. We don't think that way anymore about unrhymed poetry, but then they did. Well, I want to read you two of my very earliest poems, which will, I think, answer the question as to when I began to write and how I began to write. And I'll read you two that were written in high school. The first one is a poem in the manner of Paul Ernst Dunbar, a little Negro dialect poem called Dressed Up. And it's about a boy who put on his best clothes. He got all dressed up, and then he found out he didn't have any girlfriend to go see. So this is the way it goes. I had my clothes clean, just like new. I put them on, but it still feels blue. I bought a new hat, sure is fine, but I wish I had back that old gal of mine. I got new shoes, they don't hurt my feet, but I ain't got nobody for to call me sweet. Sad one, isn't it? Well, a year or two later, I wrote another one about a very beautiful brown-skinned girl who came into our school from down south. At that time, the first of the great migrations of colored people from the south to the big northern industrial cities was taking place, and this girl came up from the south and into our school wearing a bright red dress. And I tried to describe the way she looked to me. Well, I was too shy in those days to put her real name on the poem. The poem is called When Sue Wears Red. Her name wasn't Sue, but this is the way I described it. When Susanna Jones wears red, her face is like an ancient cameo turned brown by the ages. Come with a blast of trumpets, Jesus. When Susanna Jones wears red, a queen from some time-dead Egyptian night walks once again. Blow trumpets, Jesus. And the beauty of Susanna Jones in red burns in my heart a love fire, sharp like pain. Sweet silver trumpet, Jesus. That's the way that girl looked at me every time she went down the hall.